Public health officials are to ramp up efforts to tackle coronavirus outbreaks in nursing homes and hospitals in response to a large increase of clusters of the disease in residential settings. That's according to the lead story in today's Irish Times. Amongst the measures expected to be introduced are increased availability of personal protective equipment and health checks for nursing home staff. Outbreak teams that can go into nursing homes to assist staff are to be set up to combat clusters of the disease. And consideration is also being given to providing separate accommodation for some nursing home and hospital staff in order to minimise the risk of transmission of the virus. For its lead story, the Irish Independent leads with the line that some junior doctors in St James's Hospital in Dublin are working 24-hour shifts as hospitals come under increasing pressure as a result of the number of staff who have contracted the infection. Hoolihan hits out at hurtful fake news about nurse deaths. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Examiner, which reports on comments made by Chief Medical Officer Tony Hoolihan as the highest number of daily deaths since the COVID-19 pandemic began was recorded yesterday at 17. He said that no nurses have died as a result of contracting the virus, despite rumours being circulated on social media. 50,000 could be infected. That's the lead headline in today's Belfast Telegraph, which reports that the number of COVID-19 deaths in Northern Ireland reached 28 yesterday. And that paper also runs with a particularly eerie front page picture of multiple graves which have been dug at Six Mile Cemetery in Antrim Town. A council spokesman is quoted saying that they have taken the preparatory measure in case staff working at the cemetery become ill over the coming weeks. If an off-licence is essential, so is a church. That comment, which was made yesterday by the Bishop of Derry, Donal McKeown, generates the lead headline in today's Irish News. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Daily Mail reports on how funeral directors are dealing with having to tell bereaved families that only 10 mourners can attend the funerals of their loved ones. Back in the front of the Times, it's reported there that critically ill Irish patients in COVID-19 intensive care units are to take part in a global clinical trial evaluating potential treatments for the virus. And finally, bereaved father Andrew McGinley, whose three young children were found dead in his home in Newcastle, County Dublin on the 24th of January, features in a story in the front of today's Examiner and inside today's Irish Daily Star. His wife, Deirdre Morley, has been charged with her murder, but has been too unwell to attend court. Last Friday, Andrew, who has been posting videos and memories of Connor, Dara and Carla on Twitter, tweeted a request for people to write to him as he self-isolates at home. And write to him they did. The paper runs with a picture of the two crates of post containing more than 1,000 letters which Andrew received as a result of his request.
You're listening to Morning Ireland. It's approaching 13 minutes past seven. Just over 2 weeks ago on St. Patrick's Day, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar spoke of the calm before the storm, of an expected surge in hospital admissions for coronavirus. The storm in its full force may not yet have arrived, but the latest figures for COVID-19 infections and fatalities leave no room for complacency. On St. Patrick's Day, there were just over 290 confirmed cases here. The figure today is 3,235, a more than tenfold increase in just 2 weeks. 17 more people with the disease have died. Last night, the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Hoolihan, gave an update on those fatalities.
In respect of the deaths overall, we've now had 71 people who have lost their lives, 52 of whom are male, 19 of whom are female. 83% of them are over the age of 70. Two-thirds of them are in the east of the country, which is in line with most of the other parameters of this disease. 54 we have reports of underlying health conditions, and 59 of them occurred in hospital environments.
The World Health Organization says to combat the disease, countries must test, test and test in order to track and isolate the infection. Dr. Killian de Gascoigne, director of the National Virus Reference Laboratory, says more than 30,000 tests have been performed in this country, but there are delays of more than a week in returning results to some patients.
The positivity rate up till last week was 6%. And the positivity rate of those samples that have been tested in the last week has increased to 15%. So that's really one of the things we were trying to achieve by changing the case definition to ensure we were testing the right people. And that's certainly early signs of that we've managed to achieve that to an extent. People will be aware of significant constraints on testing at a global level from a supply chain perspective and significant laboratory reagents. So what we've been doing over the last week is prioritising hospitalised patients and healthcare workers and others in vulnerable groups. So unfortunately, there will be an awful lot of people in the community who will have been waiting maybe 7 to 10 days for a result. And that was obviously unanticipated and is unfortunate, but it doesn't really change our plan of ramping up testing over the coming weeks to achieve between 10 and 15,000 tests per day. I suppose the message for those individuals is that the test is really being performed for a population benefit more so than the benefit to the individual. So they need to self-isolate if they're symptomatic for 14 days. And as I said, we will get a result to them. Everybody that's in the system will be tested.
Let's talk now to our health correspondent, Fergal Barris. Fergal, I'll come to this issue of testing in just a moment. But first of all, you might just give us a sense of the picture in relation to the total number of confirmed cases here, people presenting at hospital and ICU admissions. What's the picture that's emerging?
Well, we've seen 71 COVID-19 related deaths here and a total number of 3,235 confirmed cases with the median age of 47 years. In relation to intensive care units, 113 people have been admitted to intensive care units, and overall over 700 people have been hospitalised. We've also seen 118 clusters of infection in various places, in hospitals but also in nursing homes. And in terms of the deaths, you will have seen that of those 71 deaths, 83% were over the age of 70, which does go to emphasise the importance of cocooning, even though that can understandably be very difficult for older people, particularly those who feel very fit and well and are used to being very active.
I know Tony Hoolan last evening was reluctant to characterise this as the start of the surge, but certainly the numbers are picking up very, very significantly.
They are. And then you also look at the fact that 25% of all of those with the virus confirmed cases are health staff, 647. I mean, that remains a very worrying and growing figure.
In relation then to testing and the delays and the shortfall in the number of tests being carried out, which we saw or heard Dr. De Gasquin there acknowledging, what's happening in relation to that and what does it mean for the public health efforts to try to contain the virus?
Well, there have been major problems in getting securing testing kits and also getting what are called reagents, which are used by the laboratories to do those tests. There's a huge worldwide demand, we heard last night, with some suppliers saying that demand is up 1,000%. So that's a real challenge. So what's actually happened is the number of tests performed has fallen to 1,500 in some cases, so over some days. So that's a problem. But 30,213 tests have been performed to date, despite those delays. And as we heard from Dr. Killian de Gascoigne, the turnaround time for testing in the community, some tests taking up to 10 days. I am aware of cases where people are waiting 13 or 14 days for the results, including in some cases doctors and nurses. So it is a major problem. They have been prioritising health staff, they say, so that will be the reason why some people in the general community might be waiting a long period of time.
And do we know anything about the efforts to try to acquire more of the test kits, more of the material that's necessary?
Well, they continue. I mean, deliveries from China continue. There are continuing flights. We were told that all of the test centres will have reopened today. So that's important. I suppose one of the issues is that because of the more focused testing now, you see that 15% of tests are testing positive compared to 6% under the old criteria. Now, that's good and bad. It's good because you're identifying in this more focused way true case, confirmed cases, but the numbers are increasing. There's another important point to make. The criteria for contact tracing is now being changed. It's going to take in the period from 48 hours before the onset of symptoms for people. So you could see they're casting the net wider in that regard. That could also push up the number of contact positives.
There's also another recommendation from the National Public Health Emergency Team, and that is in relation to health workers not sharing accommodation, Fergal. And this is something which they want to see reduced. But what's the plan to do that?
So things were moving so fast yesterday. You'll recall the National Public Health Emergency Team met in the morning, but such was the pace of movement on this issue that even by the time the media briefing last night was happening, the letter by the National Public Health Emergency Team to go to the minister hadn't been finalised. So that was being finalised last night to go to the minister last night or early this morning, and it's going to make a number of recommendations. It won't be a directive or mandatory for health staff to ensure that they don't share accommodation, but the advice will be to not share accommodation. For example, just think of it for a minute, Brian. You could have, and it's quite common, three or four nurses or healthcare staff, healthcare assistants sharing accommodation, but working in four different nursing homes or four different hospitals. And so the aim is to reduce the risk of infection. So they would be offered alternative accommodation, in particular probably hotel rooms, by the state will pay for this and provide this, because there are plenty, reportedly, of hotel rooms free at this time. The other linked issue to that is that in terms of locums, that the advice or recommendation really would be that there would be restrictions on locum health staff working in lots of different health facilities for the very same reason.
And just finally, briefly, if you can, Fergal, a word about these clinical trials that are to begin here. I think part of an international clinical trials on patients who are critically ill with the virus. What do we know about that?
Yes, I mean, there are a range of clinical trials on potential vaccines. There are potential treatments, certainly for people around the world. And Ireland is involved in an international trial, which has been supported by the Health Research Board in terms of funding. It's going to look at cases where people are critically ill to see what type of treatments might assist them. It's going to be a challenging trial. In some cases, people who are critically ill may not be able to understandably give permission to be involved. So their loved ones may be asked for permission on their behalf to enrol them in a trial, and the aim is to try and find treatments that help or support or improve the condition of people in critical care. It's a vital right. trial, and it's a positive thing that Irish experts will be involved in.
Yeah. And we'll be hearing from the lead consultant on that a little later in the programme. But for the moment, Fergal Bowers, thank you very much for that.
Stay safe, stay at home. But what if home is not safe? Reported incidents of domestic violence have increased by 16% in the last year, and organisations working with people who are abused in their own home are concerned that that abuse will get worse as people are further confined inside. As Paul Reynolds reported earlier, Gardaí say victims of domestic abuse and coercive control will continue to receive the highest priority. Let's speak to Declan Daly. He's Detective Chief Superintendent and Head of the Garda Síochána's National Protective Services Bureau. Declan Daly, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin, and thank you for inviting me on the show.
Will reports of abuse be dealt with any differently with people confined to their homes?
No, absolutely not. Where people report domestic abuse or any other crime, we will respond very, very quickly and robustly. I mean, we have the highest ever number of staff we have on front line on the ground. And so we're anxious and eager to assist all of our victims.
How will you respond?
So at the moment, we're looking at, obviously, the current crisis brings, I suppose, many fears and anxieties for families throughout the country. We all understand that. But for those, as you said, for those victims of domestic violence, those fears are doubled. So as part of our community response to COVID-19, we're implementing Operation Free Shift, which is an initiative to ensure that victims of domestic abuse are supported and are protected. And you know, this is an extraordinary time, and we recognise that cohort of victims is particularly vulnerable at this time. So how we're going to manage that is, our victim services offices, we're going to utilise them to contact each and every victim, working back from 2020, so that we can ensure their safety and ensure their protection.
So you're going to get in touch with people who'd previously got in touch with you, is that right?
Correct, yeah. So where we have had previous reports of domestic violence, we're going to proactively engage with those people again to make sure that they're safe.
An abuser not being out of the home, an abuser or an addict drinking at home or who can't get access to drugs, a child stuck in a house with somebody who's abusing them, how can you reassure them that you can help them now?
Well, it's the response. So, you know, obviously when they need a call for service, or if they indicate us that there's pressures at home or there's troubles at home, we're already very active in the community, and we're assisting the elderly, we're assisting the vulnerable. So this is just another part of that, and we will assist those people. So if they look for and they need assistance, a Garda Síochána will be there for them.
Is there any evidence that the increase, the 16% increase in the last year, includes a rise in incidents since the isolation rules came into effect, or is it too early to say?
It's too early to say. I mean, at any one time, and I suppose particularly since the new legislation was introduced last year, there's been an increase, and that's a positive thing. That means this abuse and this notification of it is coming out from behind closed doors. So there's lots of work there done by NGOs, by Garda Síochána, that contribute to that increase in reporting.
Do you expect an increase in requests for interim barring orders?
Yeah, we would expect that. I know from our liaison with the court services that the court services are available on Garda Síochána. I think the important message, Gavin, for everyone to hear today is that there's no loss of service on the Garda Síochána. There's no loss of service in the court services. That if people need a barring order, if they need an emergency barring order, an interim barring order, that those services are there. If they need on Garda Síochána, that those services are there too.
And you say you're going to implement a pro-arrest policy. What does that mean?
Well, so when an offence, when an arrestable offence has been committed, we have a pro-arrest policy that we arrest the culprit in relation to that offence.
Declan Daly, Detective Chief Inspector and or Detective Chief Superintendent rather, and Head of the Guard at National Protective Services Bureau. Thank you very much for taking our call this morning.
There was an abrupt and steep fall in manufacturing activity in March, according to the latest measure of activity from AIB, and worse is yet to come. The Purchasing Managers Index dipped into contraction in March with falling orders and output, and employment fell at its fastest pace since July 2009. Further sharp falls in activity are expected in the coming months. The video conferencing app Zoom, which has become increasingly popular as more people work remotely, has come under greater scrutiny for alleged security issues. The New York Attorney General has requested information on what security enhancements it's put in place. The app has reportedly experienced security flaws in the past. U.S. stock markets ended their worst quarter since the financial crisis with a late sell-off last night. A partial rally over the last week saw markets make back some of the massive losses they've put in since the start of March, but they still remain about a fifth lower than they were at the start of the year. Currencies, the euro is trading at $1.10 and 89 pence sterling.
And as unprecedented laws restricting the movements of people are rushed through parliaments right across the world, there's growing concern over how they're being imposed and how long they could last. In Hungary this week, the parliament there approved laws that enable the Prime Minister there, Viktor Orban, to rule by decree with no time limit and long jail sentences for anyone found guilty of spreading false information about the virus. The European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen says the Commission will closely monitor, in a spirit of cooperation, the application of emergency measures in all member states, and that such measures must be limited. She didn't rule out, or rather, she didn't single out Hungary or its leader. Sophie In't Veld is a Dutch Liberal MEP who chairs the European Parliament's Rule of Law Group. She says that the actions of the Hungarian government are incompatible with EU membership, and she's on the phone now. Sophie In't Veld, good morning to you.
Yes, good morning.
Explain to me how the actions of the Hungarian government, in your view, are incompatible with EU membership.
Well, I think we can safely say we're dealing here with a full-blown crisis of democracy right in the heart of Europe, because it's not just the measures that he has taken now in view of the corona crisis, but for the last 10 years, he has very systematically been silencing any critics and opponents. He has effectively gagged the media, undermined the independence of the judiciary, freedom of academia, freedom of speech, harassing and intimidating NGOs. So basically, he's ruling like an autocrat. It's not a democracy anymore. The last elections were deemed to be free but not fair, because there were so many obstacles, so many hurdles for opposition parties. And then when Quite surprisingly, in the local elections last year, opposition parties did quite well. He immediately changed the law on, you know, what powers local government has. So basically, and we see that there has been hardly any response. He's been in power for over 10 years. His political family is just turning a blind eye, the European People's Party, the Christian Democrats, which is also the party, incidentally.
Has that party not been excluded from the EPP?
Not really, no. They, just before the elections, they started to realize that, you know, in some countries this goes down really badly, and they pretended that they suspended him. And that they took the time to look into the matter as if they didn't know what had happened over the last 10 years. And then immediately after the elections, you know, in the European Parliament, for example, the people of his party are still up for, they're still proposed by their European party for all sorts of jobs. So, you know, effectively there is no suspension. They're turning a blind eye. And okay. I know that there is a part of the Christian Democrat family who is equally outraged and worried. There have been proposals to expel him, but so far they've been unable to do so because clearly power is more important than principles. And it reminds me very much of the situation with Trump and the impeachment procedure, and the Republicans being unable to vote for impeachment because, you know, he was one of theirs, even though many Republicans are very uneasy with okay. the way that Trump is breaking the law.
It's 7:30. I'll get to our news headlines shortly. In your view, what can and should the EU do about Hungary?
Well, the European Parliament has already, I think a year and a half ago, voted to start the procedure for suspension of the membership of Hungary. And we have been calling on the member states who come together in the Council of the European Union, to proceed with that, because they will have to take a decision. But they're pretending that nothing is wrong, because it's very uneasy to sanction somebody from your own circle, and that shows that the whole setup of the intergovernmental okay. cooperation in the European Union is not the appropriate platform to sanction when democracy, the rule of law, and fundamental rights are under attack.
Sophie Intveld, Dutch Liberal MEP, thank you very much for speaking to Morning Ireland. While the streets of much of Europe are relatively empty, in Sweden it's a different story. Here's an account of the Swedish city of Malmö in recent days, as reported by the Guardian newspaper. Outdoors, couples stroll arm in arm in the spring sunshine. Malmö's cafe terraces do a brisk trade. On the beach and surrounding parkland, there were picnics and barbecues this weekend. The adjoining skate park and playground were rammed. No one was wearing a mask. But over 200 university professors and researchers have called on their government to respond with tougher measures. Professor Carl-Henrik Helden is one of them. He's from the Department of Medical Biochemistry and Microbiology at Uppsala University. He's also chairman of the board of the Nobel Foundation, but he's speaking with us in a personal capacity this morning. Professor Henrik Helden, good morning, and thank you for taking our call today.
Good morning.
Tell me about how Sweden is managing the spread of coronavirus, because they've had over 4,000 positive cases and 180 deaths so far.
Yes.
And how is Sweden managing the spread?
Well, the government has introduced a number of measures during the last week, which has happened after this petition was formulated. For instance, now the assemblies has been limited to 50 people. It was allowed 500 before. There is also some restrictions at restaurants. They are still open, but people need to be served sitting down at their tables. And after ski, the ski resorts has been closed. And also there is a commitment to make testing more wide. And this goes both for test for who is infected and also for who is immune. And yesterday the government also introduced forbid to visit homes for elderly. And I think that these measurements are all very, very reasonable and steps in the right direction. Otherwise, the policy of the government is to give recommendations to people how to behave and how to deal with the pandemic. And I think that overall this has worked rather well.
Why do you think Sweden has been slower to restrict people's movements compared to your neighbours in Norway and Denmark, for example?
Well, different countries have to make their own judgments. I think in Sweden there is overall a rather good trust towards the authorities and the government. And if the government make recommendations, people normally follow those. And I think this is the most important thing here in Sweden, which has made it possible to be a little bit less forbidding and leave it to people to take responsibility on their own.
Do you feel safe?
I feel fairly safe, yes, and I do follow the recommendations. I do go to work and I keep distance to my colleagues and I wash my hands regularly and often and thorough.
But the streets are more crowded, people are gathering in bigger numbers, life is far less restrictive in Sweden.
Well, I live in Uppsala, which is a rather small town, and I go to and from work by bike. So for me, it's not difficult sort of to be at distance from people.
Do you want Sweden to introduce more measures?
I think that the government is following very carefully the development, and they have assured us that they are prepared to take more severe measurements if they feel that that is needed. And I have confidence that they can make appropriate judgments built on the advice they get from the experts.
Professor
and I should say that I myself is a cancer researcher. I am not an epidemiologist. I'm not a virologist.
Professor Carl Henrik Helton, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning from Sweden, from the Department of Medical Biochemistry and Microbiology at Uppsala University in the north of the country. 7:41 now.
Cancer patients from around the country are appealing to all of us to maintain social distancing so they can continue their treatment in as safe an environment as possible. The Irish Cancer Society has produced a video called My Life Matters, featuring cancer patients and survivors who typically will have a compromised immune system because of the disease and their treatment. On the line is Averil Power, CEO of the Cancer Society, and cancer patient and campaigner Vicky Phelan. A very good morning to you both, and thank you for talking to us this morning. Vicky, perhaps I can come first to you, and maybe you might give us a sense of how this pandemic has affected you as a cancer patient, your social interactions and your treatment. How have things changed?
Quite drastically, actually, Brian. I suppose I've been self-isolating from a very early stage. I made the decision around the 4th of March, I think now, going back when we had, I think, maybe two cases or something at that stage, to kind of stop all social interactions, because I actually had a very busy few weeks coming up with the International Women's Day. I had a lot of events on actually from the 4th of March onwards, and that would have involved me, you know, attending functions where there were maybe, you know, upwards of 150 people. And my oncologist actually contacted me, because he's on Twitter as well, Professor John Crown, and he noticed that I had a lot coming up. And in fairness to him, he recommended that I pull out at that stage, even when we had very small numbers, because he could see that this was going to escalate. You know, for me at the beginning, I think, you know, some of my friends thought I was crazy, that I was, you know, starting at such an early stage. But I'm glad now I did, you know, for myself and for other people, Brian, because, you know, whatever about me, yes, obviously, you know, I'm trying to keep myself alive here, and that has been my aim for the past 2 years. I want to make sure that I don't infect other people either. So I'm very glad that I kind of took that decision fairly early on.
So you've been cocooning then from the early part of the month, but you're due to travel, I think, to Dublin next week. Is that right, for treatment? And you've presumably been thinking about how you can stay safe and protect yourself on that journey and in the hospital.
Exactly. So I contacted Professor Crown about treatment to see what the measures were in place for me to, you know, so that I knew in advance how to prepare myself. So, you know, all of the patients in Vincent's hospital have been moved, all the cancer patients, over to the private hospital, because the public hospital obviously is a COVID-19 hospital. So that's where I'll be having my treatment next Wednesday. Normally I take public transport, Brian, but next week I'm not going to do that, obviously, because I can't take that risk. So I'm going to drive up. I hope to God I'll be able to get parking. You never know. It's usually a very busy hospital, but I have to be prepared. And even simple things like it's a 2.5 hour journey for me to drive from Limerick. Normally I would actually have to stop and go to the toilet on the way. These are very detailed things I have to think about. But like even something like that, I'm kind of thinking, I don't know if I can do that because it's taking a risk, stopping off at a petrol station, having to sanitize, going in, going out, the toilets, all of that. So, it's all these things that you have to take into consideration.
Avril, if I can bring you in here, how is the pandemic changing how cancer patients are being treated and how they're approaching their situation?
Well, I think many, first Brian, like Vicky, have been cocooning for weeks, pretty much since you started to get community spread of this virus in Ireland to protect themselves. Cancer patients, particularly those on active treatment, are particularly vulnerable to catching viruses like coronavirus. So many have been staying at home, limiting their interactions and doing their best to protect themselves. In today's video, they're also calling on everyone else to do the same, because I think it's important that every single one of us sees ourselves as part of the front line against this virus, that we all have to do everything we can to control in the community, to protect cancer patients and also those who are other groups that are particularly vulnerable. In terms of the impact on treatment, there's been a number of things. We've already had some treatment has been postponed. As I said, active treatment does have an impact on your immune system. It makes you more vulnerable. So doctors in each individual case have had to weigh up the risks of somebody being more susceptible to the virus as a result of the treatment. The risks also of travelling to treatment and potentially picking up the virus against the benefits of going ahead with the treatment at this time. So many patients have already had treatment postponed. We've been reassured, and I spoke to the Minister again about this yesterday, that that's only happening in cases where the treatment is not urgent and where the individual benefits in the individual case, the benefit of postponing is better than the risk that it may affect long-term outcomes. But it, in every case, that is distressing. Patients are worried about not being able to go ahead with treatment that they would have expected to be doing a month ago.
Vicky, we're all, I suppose, anxious about a situation that might arrive if our hospital system becomes overwhelmed by the number of people presenting with coronavirus, and that doctors may have to make that dreadful decision who to treat. Is that something that's of particular concern to cancer patients?
Oh, God, yeah. I think that was the first thing that came to my mind, to be honest. Ever before, I read about the cases in Italy where doctors did have to make that decision. And I suppose for me, Brian, I'm delighted to still be here 2 years later, to be honest, considering, I wasn't given that amount of time at the very beginning. So I've kind of made my peace with that. And I would hope that if a doctor had to make that decision and was presented with, two patients, me and another person who was, around the same age and who had a better chance of survival, and I know this sounds very harsh, but that's my, I suppose I've had to get my head around that. I would hope that the doctor would make the decision to save the person who would have least complications and better chance of survival. But that's something that I suppose I've had to get my head around quite a long time ago, and I don't think it's fair that our doctors are going to be put in that position. But I suppose I'd be having that conversation myself, maybe to make it easier on somebody if it got to that point. But that's exactly why I've been isolating myself, Brian, since such an early stage, because I don't want to put the doctors in that position.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing to say, Vicky. Really, quite extraordinary conclusion to have come to. Just finally, Avril, that also raises the issue, I think, for many cancer patients, particularly perhaps at an advanced stage in their disease, about concern that if they're in an end of life situation, who will be there with them? Will they be alone? Will they be able to have those they love around them?
I think that's already become challenging. We've seen reports already of funerals going ahead where family, friends and family members can't be present. In terms of people who are terminally ill, we are still providing our night nursing service. That's a free service where our nurses go in and care for patients who are terminally ill in their own homes. We're thankfully still able to run that in a way where we can protect the nurses and when there's proper social distancing within the family. But it is challenging. Mm-hmm. It is putting families in awful situations, not to be able to spend as much time as they would have liked with their broader family and friends in their final days. And I think that's why, as Vicky said, it's so important that all of us does everything we possibly can to contain the spread, because, I think thankfully, our government acted a lot faster than the Italians and some other countries in terms of putting in place restrictions. Hopefully, that means that we'll never face the kind of scenarios that we have there. Mm-hmm. But it's really in all of our power. That's not something that's up to Leo Varadkar or Simon Harris or anybody else. That's up to all of us to step up, control this virus, stay home, protect the vulnerable in our community, and make sure that we can avoid the worst so that people with cancer continue to get urgent treatment, and that as soon as possible they can come out of cocooning, be around their family and friends again, and resume their treatment as normal.
That's what we all want. Avril, thank you very much indeed. That's Avril Power from the Irish Cancer Society, and Vicky Phelan speaking to us there. And all the best to you in your continuing treatment, Vicky, and thanks for talking to us this morning. And just to say that the Irish Cancer Society operates its nurse line on free phone. If you'd like to give them a call, it's 1-800-200-700. That's the Irish Cancer Society nurse line, free phone, 1-800-200-700.
Brian Finn has the business news.
Thanks, Gavin. There was an abrupt and steep fall in manufacturing activity in March, according to AIB's latest measure of activity in the sector. Oliver Mangan is chief economist with AIB. Not much of a surprise in the context of what we're dealing with, Oliver. Perhaps the surprise is that maybe it wasn't worse.
Yeah, well, we've had surveys now from a number of countries, the Eurozone, the UK, the US, and similar declines. The early indications from those countries is actually the fall in services was much worse. Now, we won't get the Irish services figures until Friday, but still, all the same, manufacturing did see a very steep decline in activity in the month of March. It's down into what we call contraction territory or recession levels. We haven't seen figures like this since back in 2008 and 2009. And I suppose a worry in the data was the steep decline in orders in particular. So that would suggest that over the next couple of months we're going to see further declines in output. So it's a very weak report. I think it's the start of a number of weak reports we're going to see, given the virtual shutdown in the economy here and elsewhere. And I say collapsing orders, collapsing expectations in terms of output going forward, jobs being shed, and also backlogs being depleted. So, you know, normally manufacturers have orders in place, but they were run down pretty quickly in March as new orders dried up.
So you're looking at more falls for the months ahead. Would you be anticipating a fairly quick bounce back in activity down the road?
Well, actually, just looking at the data, in the last recession back in 2008-2009, the index dropped below 50, which is a separate expansion from contraction, and it remained below that level for 2 years. We would expect on this occasion that, you know, once restrictions are lifted, that activity can bounce back again. This was a very sudden, steep decline in the manufacturing output activity. So hopefully when restrictions are lifted, we'll see a sharp rebound. Unlike normal recessions where it gradually falls and then gradually recovers, and it takes a long time to get back to actually seeing a rise in output.
Oliver Mangan, Chief Economist with AIB, thank you. We're also joined on the line by Brendan Sinnott, CEO of the eServices and Communications Credit Union, which is rebranding to First Tech this week. I understand you're still open for business, Brendan, mainly in the online sphere. So you're pressing ahead with the rebranding. Is there much of a demand for services at the moment?
Absolutely. It's been a very, very good last week, believe it or not, for the credit union. We've seen no let up in lending, and we've seen some people planning for the long term in lending as well. Even last week, we had an application in for a guy buying an RV to go tour Europe and looking for a 50,000 loan to do it. So people are seeing value in the market and taking those opportunities when they're there. So certainly it will become more and more difficult over the next couple of weeks as we wait to see what way this will pan out.
So there's an appetite for lending there, even though we're looking at a fairly big contraction in the economy.
Absolutely. I mean, credit unions are one of the most trusted brands in Ireland, and they will not be found wanting in this case. We will see applications for forbearance and stuff like that, but every credit union will treat each application on its merits and will be accommodating.
And has there been much of a demand for forbearance on repayments?
Probably less than we would have expected at this stage. I think we haven't been through a full monthly cycle yet, so it will pan out, or it will kind of demonstrate once full months have been done what the real demand is.
And how is the sector responding to that? We know the banks have put measures in place to allow it for a period of time. Will the credit union sector treat it in a similar fashion?
It will, of course, but it will treat every case on its merits, but it will be accommodating.
Brendan Sinnott, CEO of eServices and Communications Credit Union, which is becoming First Tech this week. Thank you very much. And I'll have more business news at 8:30.
Let's take a check on the weather prospects for the day ahead. Jean Byrne is at Met Aaron. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning. Well, a little change for today. Another mostly dry day with some bright spells, quite a lot of cloud about though, and a few scattered showers will occur, most of them in the northern half of the country. And then later today, we'll have patchy rain and drizzle developing on north and northwest coasts. Highest temperatures today, 8 to 11 degrees. That's still below normal. The wind's just light to moderate northwesterly. Tonight will still be dry in most areas, but patchy rain and drizzle will move inland across Ulster and also affecting parts of Connacht by morning. Minimum temperatures will range 1 to 6 degrees. It'll be coldest in the south. The winds tonight will be mostly light to moderate, west to northwest in direction, but they'll be fresh to strong on northern coasts. Then the weather will turn gradually more unsettled. Tomorrow, Thursday, will be mostly cloudy, with rain and drizzle in northern and northwestern areas in the morning, moving gradually southwards, but becoming very light and patchy. Parts of Munster and South Leinster will see little or no rainfall. Clearer conditions then, with isolated showers, will follow into the northern half of the country through the afternoon and evening. Highest temperatures tomorrow, 9 to 12 degrees. The winds will be mostly moderate, west to northwest, but fresh to strong on Ulster coasts. Friday will have good dry intervals in most places, but will be a cloudy day with some patchy light rain and drizzle, mainly in parts of the west and south. A few bright spells also and scattered showers in the north and northwest. Highest temperatures 8 to 11 degrees on Friday, in light west to southwest breezes. Saturday will be dry in most areas, but still with a good deal of cloud, and patchy rain and drizzle will occur, mainly in southern coastal counties and also in the southwest. And it'll be breezy with moderate south to southeast winds, but they'll be fresh or strong in coastal areas. Highest temperatures 10 to 13. Then on Sunday, we'll see a big difference. Outbreaks of rain will extend gradually from the southwest and west, persistent in places with some heavy bursts. It'll be a very windy day also with strong and gusty southerly winds, but mild with highs of 11 to 14 or 15 degrees. Then the weather will remain changeable and unsettled throughout next week, but mild. Finally, quick recap on today's weather. Mostly dry with bright spells, but there will be some scattered light showers. And later today, patchy rain and drizzle will develop on north and northwest coasts. Highest temperatures 8 to 11 degrees, in light to moderate northwest breezes. That's all from us at Met Éireann. Good morning.
It's 8 o'clock. Good morning again on Wednesday, the 1st of April. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Brian Dobson and Gavin Jennings. The news is read by Brian Jennings.
The number of people with coronavirus who have died in the Republic and in Northern Ireland has risen to 99. There are now 3,821 confirmed cases on the island of Ireland. The Public Health Agency in Northern Ireland said that six more people with COVID-19 had died, bringing the total to 28. 53 new cases were confirmed. Yesterday, 17 more people with the infection died in the Republic, bringing the number of deaths to 71. It was the highest daily increase so far. A further 325 cases were identified. Our health correspondent Fergal Bowers.
The Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, said that the average number of contacts of confirmed cases of the virus had reduced from 5 to around 3, which was a significant continuing improvement. Over 30,200 tests have been performed, but the HSE has acknowledged long delays for some people, with test result times of up to 10 days. The test delays have been due to a shortage of test kits and reagents for laboratories, as well as a focus on priority testing for health staff. All test centres have reopened, and the HSE believes test delays will ease. Separately, the National Public Health Emergency Team is advising that in certain cases, health staff consider not sharing accommodation to reduce the risk of spread of the virus. In such cases, they would be offered alternative accommodation by the state.
In an interview with RTE last night, the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, sympathised with the families whose relatives had succumbed to the virus.
Our thoughts and prayers are with all of the families affected, and really I think this drives home the message as to why we must do absolutely everything we possibly can on an individual level, as families, and indeed as a state, to make sure we slow down the spread of this virus. And the people are making progress in helping to slow that down, but we have to keep at it.
Gardaí say that in spite of the current restructuring, with more officers on the streets, victims of domestic violence and coercive control will continue to receive the highest priority for service. They also say they will be contacting previous victims of domestic abuse to ensure they are safe. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
The Gardaí say they recognise the increase in anxiety and fear felt by victims of domestic violence and coercive control because of the COVID-19 restrictions which require people to remain in their homes. Today they launched an initiative to reassure victims. They say officers from the Garda Victims Service nationwide will contact previous victims to ensure that they and their families are safe. The head of the Garda's Protective Services Bureau says that even though there are more Gardaí on the streets on other duties, the COVID-19 outbreak has not diminished its service. Chief Superintendent Declan Daly says the Garda has a pro-arrest intervention policy in these cases and has urged people experiencing such abuse to contact them immediately. Reported incidents of domestic violence have increased by 16% in the past year, but the Gardaí say that they have not recorded a significant increase since the introduction of the coronavirus public health measures.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that the coronavirus pandemic could trigger conflicts around the world. Describing the virus as the worst global crisis since the Second World War, Mr. Guterres said it represented a threat to everybody in the world. He added that its economic impact would bring a recession that had no parallel in the recent past. Mr. Guterres also said that poorer countries needed immediate assistance if the coronavirus is to be defeated.
It is essential that developed countries immediately assist those less developed to bolster their health systems and their response capacity to stop transmission. Otherwise, we face the nightmare of the disease spreading like wildfire in the global south, with millions of deaths and the prospect of the disease re-emerging where it was previously suppressed.
Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil negotiating teams are expected to meet again today to discuss policies for a possible programme for government. The parties are seeking to agree a document that would pave the way for detailed discussions with other smaller parties and independents, which would be needed to form a government with a stable working majority. Our political correspondent Micheál Lann.
These talks between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are described as making steady progress, but it seems they may have some distance left to run before they reach the finish line. There is ongoing contact between the parties, but much of that centres exclusively on the COVID-19 crisis. The indications right now suggest that forming a government in the midst of this traumatic period could take several more weeks. Even if an agreement is reached between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, then at least one other party and a number of independent TDs would have to support it. For that reason, many will be watching the outcome of the Labour Party leadership contest, which will be announced on Friday afternoon. Already some independent TDs have submitted detailed policy documents to both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
The body of a woman in her 50s was found yesterday in a house in Killiney in County Dublin in what Gardaí are describing as unexplained circumstances. The house is located in Ballure off Church Road. Gardaí say the course of their investigation will be determined by a post-mortem examination that's due to take place today. Now the time is coming up to 7 minutes past 8.
RTÉ Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks, proudly powering Irish homes, farms and businesses. ESB Networks, serving all electricity customers. See esbnetworks.ie.
It'll be generally dry today with bright spells. There'll be scattered light showers, most of which will be in the northern half of the country. Patchy rain and drizzle will develop on north and northwest coasts this evening. Highest temperatures will range from 8 to 11 degrees.
Here with the newspapers this morning is Fiona Kelly.
Worst day ever for deaths. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Daily Mirror, which runs alongside the figure 17, the number of people who died of COVID-19 in Ireland yesterday. Public health officials are to ramp up efforts to tackle coronavirus outbreaks in nursing homes and hospitals in response to a large increase of clusters of the disease in residential settings. That's according to the lead story in today's Irish Times. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Independent leads with the line that some junior doctors in St James's Hospital in Dublin are working 24-hour shifts as hospitals come under increasing pressure as a result of the number of staff who have contracted the infection. Houlihan hits out at hurtful fake news about nurse deaths. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Examiner, which reports on comments made by Chief Medical Officer Tony Houlihan yesterday, who said that no nurses have died as a result of contracting the virus, despite rumours being circulated on social media. 50,000 could be infected. That's the lead headline in today's Belfast Telegraph, which reports that the number of COVID-19 deaths reached 28 in Northern Ireland yesterday. The paper also runs with a particularly eerie front page picture of multiple graves which have been dug at Six Mile Cemetery in Antrim Town. A council spokesman was quoted saying that they have taken the measure in case staff working at the cemetery become ill over the coming weeks. If an off-licence is essential, so is a church. That comment, which was made yesterday by the Bishop of Derry, Donal McKeown, generates the lead headline in today's Irish News. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Daily Mail reports on how funeral directors are dealing with having to tell bereaved families that only 10 mourners can attend the funerals of their loved ones. For its lead story, the Irish Daily Star reports that Cork City Council is this week paying its 31 councillors a three-month allowance in advance, amounting to a total of almost €40,000. Cork Mayor Councillor John Sheehan tells today's paper that the decision was taken to free the council's administrative staff from their workload during the COVID-19 crisis, since many of them are working from home. Back on the front of the Times, it's reported there that critically ill Irish patients in COVID-19 intensive care units are to take part in a global clinical trial evaluating potential treatments for the virus. The Independent runs with a front page story about the McGrady family from Swords, County Dublin, who lost their father, John, at the age of 82 on Sunday to COVID-19. Their 79-year-old mother, Nell, who was at their father's bedside in the nursing home when he died, has also contracted the virus. And over in the front of the Examiner, there's an interview there with the parents of a two-year-old child who contracted COVID-19. Bereaved father Andrew McGinley, whose three young children were found dead in his home in Newcastle, County Dublin, on the 24th of January, also features in a story on the front of today's Examiner and inside today's Star. His wife, Deirdre Morley, has been charged with the children's murder, but has been too unwell to attend court. We're told that after Andrew tweeted a request for people to write to him as he self-isolates at home, he received more than 1,000 letters from well-wishers. A number of today's papers report that the GoFundMe page Feed the Heroes for frontline healthcare workers has received more than €550,000 in donations. And finally, the Examiner has a nice story today about Cork postman Kevin Ruby, who has been cheering everyone up on his postal round in Mallow by wearing a costume which makes it look as if he's been carried around by his own personal assistant, Teddine the Teddy Bear. Kevin tells Owen English, "It's nice to see smiles and laughs coming out of the windows and doors in the tough times we're in."
99 people have now died on the island of Ireland as a result of coronavirus COVID-19 infection, 71 south of the border and 28 in the north. The chief medical officer here has recommended an increased focus on trying to respond to outbreaks in nursing homes, hospitals and other residential institutions, some changes to who should be tested and to get in touch with more of the contacts of confirmed cases. Despite what was described by health officials last night as a significant fall-off in testing in recent days, there are almost 4,000 confirmed cases on the island, and more of them are requiring hospital treatment and critical care. 113 people have been admitted to ICU beds. From next week, those patients or their families will be asked to take part in trials to try and find drugs that can protect against or treat the worst effects of the virus. It's global research. And here, University Hospital Galway and St Vincent's University Hospital in Dublin will be involved first. Alistair Nicol is Professor of Intensive Care Medicine at University College Dublin. He's an intensive care consultant at St Vincent's University Hospital and clinical trial lead in Ireland. Alistair Nicol, good morning. Thank you very much for speaking to us.
You're very welcome.
Tell us about what's going to happen next week.
We have been working on a number of trials. So that's essentially a way of saying we want to figure out what treatments on top of the normal excellent intensive care treatment might improve outcomes for patients who are critically unwell in ICU with COVID-19. There are a number of treatments we're looking at, and essentially they divide into two halves. One is actually trying to address either killing the virus or stopping it getting into the body, and the other treatments are ones which actually try and dampen down the body's immune response to the infection, which can sometimes be worse than the infection itself. And we're doing this with partners across the world, and the treatments we're looking at, we as the doctors and nurses think are the most important or the most likely to work, and the WHO has prioritized them for research.
So this isn't about a vaccine, this is about treatment. What drugs are you looking at?
So, as I said, there are antiviral drugs. So these hope to tap down the viral infection. And they would be drugs like Calitra, which is a drug that's been used in HIV in the past, and hydroxychloroquine, which people may have heard about on the news as a potential treatment for COVID-19, and also anti-inflammatory drugs.
Now,
the question is, we don't know if these work or not at the moment.
What treatments are you able to use so far in ICU?
So the mainstay of intensive care is the high-quality ICU care pieces get every day. That is supportive care. So we actually try and support organs that have failed, either the lungs with breathing machines, the kidneys with dialysis machines, and allow patients to recover from an infection, such as a viral pneumonia. And these supportive cares have good outcomes. The trials we are looking at additional therapies on top of this to improve outcomes in our patients.
Your focus will be on the illest patients. Will they be
Correct.
Able to consent?
So that is a very good question. So in Ireland, we have a long history of intensive care research, and we have a network that's been funded by the HRB, and we regularly confront these issues. Some of our patients will be well enough that we can have a conversation with them and discuss the pros and cons of the studies we're taking part in. But unfortunately, the majority of our patients will be too unwell to have that conversation. And we will need to have a conversation with their next of kin. One particular aspect of COVID-19 is that normally we have this conversation at the bedside or in the hospital, but these conversations will actually happen over the phone during this particular crisis.
According to the numbers that we heard from the health authorities last night, we have 113 cases of COVID-19 treated so far in ICU beds. I don't know if you know how many of those patients are still in ICU, but I would imagine the vast majority of them. How are you coping in Vincent's?
So, I'll just speak in more in general. So the health service has been pushed in a sense that we normally have a fixed capacity. There has been a huge amount of work, and I know Catherine Motherway from the Intensive Care Society of Ireland has talked about this over the last number of days and weeks, to double the ICU capacity in all of our hospitals around the country. And that is a Herculean effort by the doctors, the nurses, the cleaners, the porters, etc. So there is there's currently extra capacity within the system to look after these patients and give them the high quality care we would on any day of the year.
What will you do when these beds are full?
So there are two aspects of that. So first of all is trying to prevent that eventuality from happening.
Yes.
The public health measures and the tracking and tracing that's being done is actually pretty exemplary in Ireland. And we hope that will start to bend the curve, as I'm sure people have heard about over the last number of days, and reduce the number of cases. There has been a large push to increase capacity, as I said, across the network. And what we're hoping in, as the researchers are, that these treatments we get, so those other measures aim to prevent people from getting the disease, and these treatments will hopefully improve survival and hopefully reduce the amount of time that patients are in ICU to further free up capacity within the system.
Can I ask you how you are, Alistair Nicol? You're in the front line of treating this disease. It must be very stressful and quite dangerous as well.
So, as I said again, there are colleagues across the system, doctors, nurses, porters, who are stepping up every day. It is pretty impressive to see the commitment that people have made to perform within their scope and beyond their scope to try and give the safest care to the patients in Ireland. And I have to say, I'm just very impressed with everybody and the common focus that everyone has in the face of this.
Professor Alistair Nicol at University College Dublin and clinical trial lead here in Ireland of treatment for coronavirus. Thank you very much for speaking to us.
Among the COVID-19 measures announced last week was the cocooning of people over 70, a request that they remain at home until Easter weekend at least, and possibly longer. But it's becoming clear over the last few days that there is some confusion as to what the new guidelines require of the over 70s. Our reporter Elise Sheehy has been speaking to Pádraig Tóil, who's from Dundalk in County Louth, and Liz Dixon from Dublin.
Well, from listening to the television and radio, I understood that you could go out walking, but I don't understand this thing of being cocooned in your house. My wife lives here with me and my daughter. But, like, what are you going to do? Get a tent and put one out in the garden, one live in the tent and one live in the house. This thing of keeping away from your partner or your wife in the house, I don't understand that at all. It's ridiculous. I'm 75, my wife's 71. You wouldn't have enough people to deliver all the groceries around Ireland if that was the case with all the over 70s in houses.
And you're living with your wife and your daughter and, you know, the guidelines are telling you that where possible, isolate yourself from other people, even if it's in your house. How do you feel about that?
I think that's impossible to do. How do you do that? Now, I'm not that stupid to know if my wife got headaches or got a bad cold or was coughing, I would think there was something wrong. I would be away immediately, you know. But to isolate yourself within a house is unbelievable.
Yes, it is working for me, personally. I am staying in completely, and I have no contact with anybody, only over the phone. And when my family come to bring anything, they just leave it at the door. I open the door, and I don't go out to them or anything. They don't come near me. But then I just come in and spend the whole day in the house or out back. Don't go out the front at all. We just keep in contact with our family over the phone. Hmm.
So, Liz, did you actually realise that unless it's essential that you should be distancing yourself from the person that you live with?
No.
And how do you feel about that?
We try to be as separate as possible in the house. Look, we find it okay. We're finding it grand because the main thing to me is that everyone is all right now, our families are all right, so we do anything. It's not making me feel as if I'm in a prison or anything now.
Liz Dixon speaking there to Elise Sheehy. Well, let's talk now to the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, who joins us. A very good morning to you, Minister, and thanks for talking to us on the programme this morning.
Thank you, Brian.
We can begin with this question of the over 70s, the cocooning of the over 70s. What is being asked of them?
Well, look, I think from listening to both Liz and Paddy's testimony there, I think you can hear how challenging it is for some people, and I suppose other people perhaps manage it a different way. What we're asking people to do is significant, but straightforward, really, in terms of the message. We're asking them to stay at home, in all circumstances, except perhaps where they need to seek medical attention or assistance. And what we're asking, I don't particularly like the word cocooning, but the idea behind it is that the supports come to them. So I already know that lots of family members are obviously dropping food and leaving it on the doorstep for their moms or their dads. We also have a number of retailers doing delivery services. But in addition to that, we've now set up a contact number in every county council or city council area in the country for any older person or person with a medical condition to contact if they need food or access to any help or support. I spoke to Age Action yesterday. I know they've started phoning over 11,000 older people across the country, checking in on them and indeed offering to call back and to keep in touch. Alone, another charitable organisation have set up a dedicated helpline. Mm-hmm. So it's tough and it's challenging.
And
but
are
we're
they
doing
being
it for one very simple reason.
I'm
yes.
sorry, are they being, are sorry, they being asked ahead. To isolate themselves from other people in the house? Is that part of this?
So you tend to be you're a close contact by virtue of the fact that you live with people in your house. But insofar as it's possible, you should keep your distance in your home from each other.
Mm-hmm. And what about those who are over 70, who are still very, very healthy, very active, large numbers of people, and they just can't understand why they shouldn't be able to go out for a walk on what might well be empty streets around their home or on quiet country roads? What harm would that be?
And I absolutely understand that, but you have to bear in mind the fact that there's an awful lot of this virus currently circulating in our country. And we know, despite the fact that 70 is not old, I'm very clear on that, and there's many active 70-year-olds in good health, the facts show that when you reach that age, you are more susceptible to getting this virus in a very serious way. So the message from all of our public health experts is clear. It is for a short period of time, and it is with one aim in mind, and that is protecting life, saving lives and keeping people safe and well. But I do want people to know they won't be left alone in these circumstances. We're asking them to help us by following these public health measures as closely as they possibly can. And we are already, and I do want to say this because I know it's a difficult and challenging time for people, we're already beginning to see the benefit of some of the measures that people have undertaken. So you'll remember when I was speaking to you last week, I was telling you that if someone was diagnosed with the coronavirus about 2 weeks ago, they had on average been in contact with 20 people. That had fallen last week to 5 people. It's now fallen to 3 people. So we know as a result of people staying at home, keeping their distance, we're making it harder for this virus to spread from one person to the other. And that is quite frankly the only way we are going to be able to slow it down. And the more we can slow it down, the more we can protect our health service in terms of the critical capacity it'll need for those who do get sick.
And those figures you cite are on the basis, presumably, of tests that are being carried out. And there's been a lot of commentary in recent days on the number of tests that have been done. We saw test centres suspending operations. People have their tests cancelled. They're waiting up to 10 days and more for their results to come through. The target is 15,000 tests a day. And, of course, we're well short of that. It's a crucial tool in getting ahead of this, ahead of this infection. When is that objective, that target of 15,000 tests a day going to be reached, do you think?
Well, we heard from Killian de Gascon, the head of the National Virulence Reference Laboratory, that he thinks there's about 10 more days in terms of putting in all of the capacity we need to really ramp up our testing. But can I just say this? We had our first case of the coronavirus in our country just a month ago. During that period of time, the health service has worked flat out to put in place the pathways and the structures to be able to provide testing. We've gone from a situation whereby you maybe needed the ambulance to call to your home to take the test to one where we now have dozens of test centres across the country. We've now secured a supply of testing kits, and the big issue now outstanding is to ramp up the lab capacity. There's huge work going in relation to that. We've gone from one lab to 10, and we're due to have more come on stream next week. But I do need to say this also. People need to know that the test does not change what they would be advised to do by their doctor. So the most important thing you do if you have symptoms is you phone your GP. And we're all being asked to stay at home at this stage, but you self-isolate and within your home. That is how you slow down the spread.
And that's a very important message to get over. But the crucial thing here is the information that the tests give those who are trying to fight this virus. And you were saying back on March 19th to my colleague Sean O'Rourke that you believe this target, or you hoped, would be reached within the next few days. That didn't happen. So why this difficulty in reaching this objective?
And hands up and complete and utter honesty here. There's no room for political answers during a pandemic. The reality is we are meeting supply constraints that lots of other countries around the world are meeting as well. The situation we're facing here is not in any way unique to Ireland, but I'm very satisfied that the health service is doing everything humanly possible to ramp up testing. In addition to that, and importantly, the National Public Health Emergency Team yesterday adopted a recommendation from the Chief Medical Officer to further improve contact tracing. So if you have somebody now who is symptomatic, and in certain groups, the contact tracing, in other words, talking to the people who have been in close contact with them, will now happen in advance of a test even taking place. So when you look across the water in the UK, or indeed when you look at most European countries, despite the difficulties that we're facing here, we are still testing more per head of population than most countries in the European Union. Indeed, more than 30,200 people have already had their test results through the labs. These are things, Brian, that in normal time, as you know, would take a year, if not longer, to set up, have been put in place within the space of a mere few weeks.
I'd like to ask you about the situation in relation to nursing homes, because we've seen and concern expressed about a number of clusters. I think 22 was the latest figure I saw for clusters of the infection in nursing home settings.
Yes.
Now, what's happening in relation, particularly about providing additional financial supports to those operating nursing homes and trying to deal with this?
So can I just say, we need to make sure we don't leave anybody behind in relation to this public health emergency. And there are two groups that I'm particularly concerned about at the moment that are the absolute focus of my work and the work of my department this week. That's those living in long-term residential settings, including nursing homes, and it's also our healthcare professionals and ensuring we protect them in all of the various settings. We have seen a number of clusters of virus break out across the nursing homes. And yes, government will look at providing financial support to help nursing homes meet those costs, but I, in terms of protecting people from COVID-19. But much more importantly, I need to talk to you this morning about some of the things we're now going to need to do in our nursing home sector to protect residents, to keep them safe, and to protect the staff as well. So we're going to be asking HICWA, who know the nursing home sector, they know it like nobody else. We're going to be asking them to help identify vulnerabilities and places at risk so we can put in more supports in terms of staff and resources. We're going to be providing more personal protective equipment. We're going to be putting in place a health check for staff at the start of each shift so that if anybody has a symptom or isn't feeling well, they can be sent home immediately so that it doesn't spread throughout the nursing home. Every nursing home is going to be asked to provide a COVID lead. And also, crucially, we're going to be providing isolation facilities where, for either staff or residents where isolation can't be provided for in the nursing home, can be offered a place.
And how
we have to get this right in the next couple of days.
And how soon would you hope to see all this coming into effect?
So I think importantly, a lot of this is already underway. There's a lot of example of best practice already in place. But from today, the HSE, HICWA and the Department of Health will be talking further to nursing homes. We'll be looking at how we can ramp up staffing resources, trying to establish, let's call them outbreak teams, where if there's a particular geographic area or number of nursing homes where there is infection, that we can support the staff working there. I really want us to get this right. We know that when it comes to mortality, we know that older people are particularly at risk. I want to make sure we can do everything we can to protect them. I also, quite bluntly and frankly, we need to make sure that the nursing homes don't become a source of spread for infection into the community. So I want to thank Nursing Homes Ireland. I met them this week, and there's a lot of work we're going to get underway this week on that.
Minister for Health, Simon Harris, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning.
Factory activity here posted its sharpest ever monthly decline in March. It resulted in the AIB Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index registering its worst reading since May 2009. The level of orders and output fell, and employment dropped at its fastest pace in almost 11 years. Britain's biggest banks have agreed to suspend dividend payments following pressure from the regulator. Six lenders had been due to pay out £8 billion in dividends from last year. The move follows a similar move from the European banks earlier this week on the instructions of the European Central Bank. European stocks have kicked off Q2 in the red. An index of stocks from across the continent is down over 2.5%. US markets capped off their worst quarter since the financial crisis with a fresh wave of selling last night. It followed a warning from Donald Trump that the country was in for a very painful few weeks with many thousands of deaths from coronavirus. Currencies, the euro is trading at just below $1.10 and 89 pence sterling.
8:39, you're listening to Morning Ireland. We haven't forgotten sports. No, not sports news, but sporting memories. We'll get to that a little bit later on. But first, supermarkets are high-risk sites of infection for the coronavirus. That's according to the Irish Global Health Network, an independent group of health workers, which has published guidelines for shoppers to help reduce the incidence of the highly infectious disease. Cian McCormack joins us to tell us more. Cian, tell us about the guidelines.
Well, Gavin, they're in a booklet called A Quick Guide to Safe Shopping During COVID-19 Pandemic. The Irish Global Health Network says it published the guide because some supermarkets are disregarding hygiene standards. Here's environmental health specialist Niall Roach, who's a board member of the Irish Global Health Network and an adjunct assistant professor at the Centre for Global Health at Trinity College in Dublin.
Before you go shopping, wash your hands.
And of course, deciding which hand to use.
Yes, I think practically for me, I'm a person who tends to touch my nose and mouth, and I'm always itching my nose. So trying to use your non-dominant hand to just to pick the goods up with and put it into your shopping basket or your trolley, or even if your own shopping bags yourselves, to avoid yourself having to touch a trolley or a basket.
But you also have after shopping guidelines. What are they?
Yeah, well, the first thing about after shopping, the first most important thing is that you wash your hands immediately after you return home. When you're bringing your shopping inside your own household, clear a designated area for your shopping, disinfect that area, wipe it down, and then stack your goods there in your shelves. And then after you've done your stacking, you can wash your hands again.
Would you clean off the surfaces of the individual items?
You may possibly want to do that. My understanding is that the risk is very low. If, for example, you're maybe buying packaged products like carrots in a bag, you may want to take the carrots out of the bag, not touching the carrots or not touching the outer covers of a yogurt packet, for example, put them in your bin, wash your hands, and then that you know that the products that you have not been handled or touched. But you may use an antiseptic on some packaging that you're going to have to be touching. But it's not, as I said, the risk is still regarded as low.
The risk is still regarded as low. That's Niall Roach. That booklet, Cian, A Quick Guide to Safe Shopping During the COVID-19 Pandemic, can be downloaded at globalhealth.ie. What are retailers saying?
The industry says retailers have made enormous efforts to make shopping safer. Here's Arnold Dillon, Director of Retail Ireland.
Over recent weeks, Irish retailers have made enormous efforts to ensure the safety of their customers and of their staff. Social distancing measures are being enforced across the sector with limits on how many people are entering a store, but also a whole range of new signs and floor markings to encourage customers to keep the 2 meter distancing. At checkouts, stores have installed Perspex screens and retailers have increased the frequency of their cleaning of the stores, of trolleys, baskets, and also of chip and pin terminals. And retailers are continuing to follow the advice of the Food Safety Authority of Ireland, who have advised that there is no evidence to date of COVID transmission through food.
No evidence to date of transmission through food. Arnold Dillon there. Cian, the Irish Global Network said in a statement yesterday that COVID-19 can live on hard surfaces like plastic and stainless steel for up to 72 hours and can live on cardboard for up to 24 hours. Is that correct?
Well, there's increasing research in this area, Gavin. Dylan H. Morris, who's a PhD candidate in ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton University in the US, has investigated how long COVID-19 can live on different surfaces. That research shows the virus is detectable for up to 24 hours on cardboard and up to 2 to 3 days on plastic and stainless steel. His work was recently published in the New England Journal of Science. I talked to him last night.
We experimentally contaminated surfaces in a safe lab environment. The big takeaway from our study is that on things like steel and plastic, the virus has a half-life of 6 to 8 hours, which means that if you put some virus there, 6 to 8 hours later, half of it will be gone. After another 6 to 8 hours, half of that will be gone. So a quarter of what was initially there will be left. After another 6 to 8 hours, you'll have an eighth of what was initially there. And it's going to keep halving like that over time. So as you can see, whatever the initial risk was is going to get lower and lower every few hours. But that said, while 6 to 8 hours, fortunately, it's not days. It's not minutes. So you come by a steel surface maybe a couple hours after someone contaminated it with quite a lot of virus, there might be some risk there. And that's why it's very important, for example, that public surfaces like handrails and subway poles be regularly cleaned.
What about cardboard? There would be a lot of cardboard if someone is doing their shopping.
So with cardboard, that was another surface we looked at. We see a shorter half-life than steel and plastic, sort of a half-life more around 3 to 4 hours, which is still a little bit long enough to be a little scary, but unless you're a postal worker sneezed on the package right before they delivered it, I wouldn't be terrified.
Well, earlier we heard about new shopping guidelines and cleaning items coming into our homes. I asked Dylan H. Morris if this is all necessary.
I would encourage people to do whatever makes them feel most comfortable. Certainly anything that's going to get cooked, if you cook something, the virus is going to struggle to do well.
And what about the packaging?
It's a question of risk reduction. None of us, I think, can eliminate all the risk in our lives. But, you know, in particular, if you've been out in public and you wash your hands, or if you've unwrapped something that was recently touched by someone else and thrown it away and then wash your hands again, yeah, it'll reduce risk a bit. Never reduces it to zero, but equally, it's not going to be as high as if you didn't do that.
That's Dylan H. Morris, who's a PhD candidate in ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton University in the US there, ending that report by Keane McCormack.